Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, January 27th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Stinging Nettle Botanics, formerly Stinging Nettle Apothecary, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Today we'll discuss breast surgical oncology with Dr. Claudia Lago of Nuvance Health. Dr. Lago treats breast conditions from benign to malignant diseases and has a special interest in high-risk patients. She routinely sees patients for hidden scar surgery, including nipple-sparing mastectomies, high-risk prophylactic surgery, and male breast cancer, among other things. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Dr. Claudia Lago and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In the studio this afternoon is Dr. Claudia Lago of Nuvance Health, board-certified in general surgery and fellowship-trained in breast surgical oncology. Dr. Lago sees all breast conditions from benign to malignant diseases and has a special interest in high-risk patients. She routinely sees patients for hidden scar surgery, including nipple-sparing mastectomies, high-risk prophylactic surgery, and male breast cancer. She has developed 5 nationally accredited breast centers throughout her career. If you have a question for Dr. Lago today, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dr. Claudia Lago, welcome.
Thank you so much, Ray. I really appreciate it.
So you developed 5 nationally accredited breast centers. How does one develop that?
I think I was thrown into the lion's den and had no idea. No, I finished my fellowship, and soon after finishing my fellowship, I ended up getting a job in South Jersey, and they wanted to develop a program there. I was the only fellowship trained breast surgeon in town, and all of a sudden, this was my homework. It became my baby, and we got nationally accredited about a year and a half later. My mom ended up getting some health issues, which made me relocate to different states. So I moved from Philly, where I was living at the time, to Florida. And they recruited me to create 3 centers over on the west coast of Florida. And I created a national protocol there, which was the first one in a community-based hospital.
Now, what do you mean? What protocol did you create?
So this protocol is for genomic testing for invasive cancers that are hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, which are stage 1, stage 2, to determine what the risk of recurrence would be, meaning are these cancers going to be high risk or low risk, and would there be a benefit for chemotherapy after treatment?
You know, developing a center of any kind probably requires a lot of business acumen. Were you out of your depth for a time when you were doing this?
I was out of debt, yes.
You're feeling all right now, though, huh?
I am. No, I actually did it because I wanted to make sure that the patients in the community were receiving the same level of care as if they would go to any other academic institution.
You know, the prevalence of breast cancer, it's pretty widespread. You'd think that there would be breast cancer centers or breast centers throughout the country in great profusion, but not so?
Not the case. And the type of accreditation that I was looking for is called National Accreditation Program for Breast Centers, what we call NAPBC. Our breast centers are currently NAPBC over at Nuvance. And that definitely means that you're following certain standards, which are national standards and also standards that are compiled by the American Society of Breast Surgeons and other institutions as well.
Well, we'll talk about some of these standards as we go along here. The number to call if you have a question for Dr. Claudia Lago today is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. In your bio, it mentions that you have an interest in managing high-risk patients. Explain.
So high-risk patients are a subset of patients where you don't have cancer, But some women don't even know that they're higher risk of breast cancer. And it does not necessarily mean that you have a family history. It could mean that you've had prior biopsies or you've never had children, which increases your estrogen exposure, or you have all of the above and you have very dense breasts. So we use an algorithm called Tyrer-Cuzick, which calculates paternal family history, maternal family history, plus your own risk factors and density, breast density as well. And it'll give us a percentage. Depending on the percentage and the number, we'll determine if your lifetime risk of breast cancer is elevated. And if your lifetime risk of breast cancer is elevated, it's something that we can certainly have a conversation and consider and add supplemental imaging like MRIs in the picture along with mammograms. Not everybody meets criteria, but if it's something that you may consider that you may think you may be high risk for multiple reasons, definitely discuss it with your doctor.
So tell me a little more about this algorithm, how it was developed. Is it constantly being tweaked and changed? And what, in fact, what are all those risk factors, or at least some of the major ones? You mentioned family history. What else?
So it started from the Gallup risk model, which was just personal history and some maternal family history, but it developed into something a little bit more comprehensive. It definitely gets continuously updated. But right now, for personal risk factors, if somebody's had a prior biopsy, age of menarche has an impact.
Can I just stop for a sec?
Of course.
Why would a prior biopsy, assuming that the prior biopsy is negative, be an enhanced risk factor?
That's a great question. Some biopsies may be high-risk lesions, and patients don't even know it. If somebody had an atypical lesion, which means a precancerous lesion, that can increase risk of breast cancer as well.
So what other factors do we have in this algorithm?
So age of menarche has a huge impact. First life child, if
interesting. What does that do?
So the reason being is that pregnancy can be a protective factor because it decreases estrogen exposure. Somebody who's never had a child has more estrogen exposure compared to other women. So these are some of the factors that will pertain to your own personal history.
So you said the age of your first live child, is that what the factor is? The age of the mom or the age of the child?
No, age of mom.
So if mom what difference does it make if the mom has one at 34 as opposed to 22?
So then if you had a child at 24, you had cut your estrogen exposure and you probably breastfed at a younger age, you have more protective factors in your body. The longer you wait for childbearing, the more risk it is.
Huh. Dr. Claudia Lago is our guest today. Breast health and breast surgery is the topic. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. How accurate is this thing? How accurate is this algorithm? In other words, here's my question. We saw the film actress, and her name eludes me at the moment. She was in Tomb Raider. But
Angelina Jolie.
That's the one. And didn't she have prophylactic double mastectomy?
She did, but she did because she had a genetic mutation. Her mutation's called a BRCA mutation, which has an increased risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer, among other cancers. And that's the reason why she decided to undergo a bilateral prophylactic mastectomy.
Now that's a huge decision. How do you, in managing high-risk patients, how do you get to that decision, and when do you say no?
So some patients meet criteria for genetic testing depending on family history and personal risk factors, depending if they've had other cancers or if it's a very strong family history of multiple cancers. I'm assuming I don't know her family history, nor do I know her own medical history, but assuming she met criteria and that's why she ended up getting tested. In the case of a BRCA mutation, there's anywhere from a 40 to 90% lifetime risk of breast cancer. So it's very high risk. Normal risk in the population, 1 in 8 women will get diagnosed with breast cancer.
1 in 8 in the general population?
In the general population.
Is that because women now live longer than they used to?
So the number has sustained the same. I think it's multifactorial. I think screening studies have improved. I think there's an incidence of obesity in our society. I think there's increased alcohol use as well. And those are
over when? I mean, people have been drinking a long time. How do we know this?
They have been drinking over a long time. There was data over COVID where people had increased their risk of alcohol consumption just because of depression and other mental health issues. So unfortunately, alcohol does increase risk of breast cancer by about 30% because it increases estrogen in your system.
All right, Christine and Waterville had that question about the info about that connection between breast cancer and alcohol use. What does the alcohol do? What's the problem?
Alcohol increases estrogen productivity in the system, and that's why it increases it. Basically, it's a driving force for changes in the breast.
Mm.
And that's why, not just for breast cancer, it's also a link increased risk for colon cancer as well.
Dr. Claudia Lago joins us today from New Vance Health. The number is 800-348-2551. And we'll get to the phones in a moment. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Peter writes in, my wife may have been told that she has dense breasts. Is this something that relates to a risk factor for cancer, which you and I spoke of, or is it only an issue in terms of diagnostics with a mammogram?
So dense breasts, so some states have a dense breast law. So, for example, New York and Connecticut have a dense breast law.
What do you mean?
So for the dense breast law, that means that when women are going for their routine screening mammograms, they should have, and we recommend to undergo a survey ultrasound, which means an ultrasound of both breasts, because mammogram alone cannot look at everything. Now, one study does not substitute the other, but women with dense breasts, when you combine the mammogram along with the ultrasound, you can have a better evaluation of what's going on with the breast tissue.
So what does the law do? Compel people to have this?
It actually allows insurance companies to cover the ultrasound.
Understand. So what makes what? Okay, so I don't know how to put this in a polite way, but breasts can be dense. What's in them that makes them dense?
So that's the glandular tissue. So the process of breast formation and the gland in terms of forming itself. So start with puberty. You start developing the gland. The gland itself has the breast tissue, which is a dense breast tissue plus fatty tissue. And it doesn't really mature until people actually breastfeed. Now, once the breastfeeding process occurs, then the gland starts to atrophy, which means it starts to degenerate and it starts to get more fatty replaced. And that's why that density changes over time from women who are young versus women who are postmenopausal.
But fatty breast tissue is a good thing, right?
Fatty breast tissue is a good thing in the sense that we can actually see things a little bit easier when women are undergoing their mammograms.
Well, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Claudia Lago joins us from New Vance Health. We'll be back. I know you remember, but don't forget, the lockbox is open. Our fund drive begins Monday at 6 a.m. Everything we raise right now counts on day one of the fund drive. You can go to wamc.org and make your online pledge. Doesn't have to be 100 or 1,000 or 50. A buck will do it. You're a full member of this station. $5. Anything you're comfortable giving, wamc.org. And we'll remind you again and again and again until then. Dr. Claudia Lago joins us from New Vance Health on this edition of Medical Monday. Dr. Lago is board certified in general surgery and fellowship trained in breast surgical oncology. And aside from breast cancer, what's the most common thing you ailment you see?
Breast pain.
Oh, hang on. We're going to turn that mic on. There we go.
We see a lot of breast pain. I get a lot of consults for breast pain, and unfortunately women associate breast pain with an indicator of breast cancer, and it's not necessarily the case. Breast pain can be for multiple reasons. Breast pain can happen because you're wearing the wrong size bra, or breast pain can happen because you're on a medication that's a stimulant, or you consume too much caffeine in your diet. So those are things, or it could be from hormonal changes.
Okay. Now, we talked about alcohol. What does caffeine do that might hurt a breast?
Caffeine does not hurt the breast. It's just a stimulant. So it can increase what we call fibrocystic changes of the breast. These cystic changes can cause discomfort, and some women tend to be more susceptible than others. And that's why, in some cases, some women tend to have more discomfort during their menstrual cycle or regardless of their menstrual cycle.
Let's go to the phones here at 800-348-2551. Vox Pop Medical Monday, Breast Health Today with Dr. Claudia Lago of Nuvance Health. We'll get back to the emails later. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email. And let's start with Danielle in Albany. Danielle, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Dr. Lago.
Hi.
I had a sebaceous cyst under my left breast, and it was treated. But I have, like, sharp pain sometimes in my left breast, and I'm wondering is it possible for the cyst to have traveled into my breast?
So that's a great question, Danielle. So sebaceous cyst is a skin condition. It's not a breast condition. It just happened to be in that area. I would certainly suggest that you be evaluated by your doctor, and just to make sure that there's nothing else going on. Sometimes you definitely need to do additional workup, but in certain cases, for the most part, like Ray and I were discussing, breast pain is not necessarily a bad problem, but I highly recommend that you seek attention from your doctor just to make sure that there's nothing more serious.
Danielle.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Before the next call, in your bio, you mention one of your specialties is nipple-sparing mastectomies. Is that a new thing?
It used to be a new thing when I was first out of training. We've actually been performing nipple-sparing mastectomies for years now. It just gives women a different approach in terms of how we perform the mastectomy. So it's a more cosmetically pleasing procedure, and it just depends on where you plan the incision. For the most part, what a nipple-sparing mastectomy entails is that we're preserving that area.
Yeah.
And oncologically, not everybody meets criteria, but oncologically, it's still safe in comparison to other women who haven't had a nipple-sparing mastectomy. Definitely something that should be discussed with your doctor. There's multiple ways of approaching this, and a lot of people can still achieve it just with different types of surgical procedures.
What is the kind of standard recovery time from surgery like this?
Usually about 6 to 8 weeks.
That's pretty extensive.
It is. It's just because of the amount of work and the healing process that's entailed. With or without reconstruction, it's the same amount of healing.
Number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Lago today, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jackie writes in, I recently had my first mammogram, which showed a small mass believed to be a fibroadenoma, but because of some worrisome characteristics, it was recommended for biopsy. I was also told I have very dense breasts. I also have fibrocystic breast changes and experience pain and lumps for 2 to 3 weeks each month. I have no family history of breast cancer, but wondering if these things put me at a higher risk. And that's from Jackie.
Well, Jackie, thank you for your question. That's a phenomenal question. I actually see a lot of consults regarding that very particular scenario. The fibroadenoma, they're usually benign nodules of the breast, but we can't really certainly determine what something is. We can just describe the characteristic just by imaging. The only way that we can determine with certainty what something is by obtaining a tissue sample. And that's probably the reason why they recommended a biopsy. Good, important to know is that for the most part, when we see an abnormality on imaging, it's still benign in nature. The reason why we go through the extent of the biopsy, it's just to exclude other lesions. So the biopsy itself is very well tolerated. It's a very small procedure. You can, for the most part, patients drive themselves to their procedure, and the recovery time is very, very short.
We're joined by Dr. Claudia Lago of Nuvance Health. Now, when you do a biopsy and it comes out okay and it's not cancer, is that person still at a higher risk for cancer down the road?
So multiple factors. We would certainly have to use that algorithm, and it's actually a computerized algorithm where we plug in certain numbers. But sometimes the factors change over time. So as patients age, it usually decreases.
Really?
It does. It does. So age factor, so somebody's risk factor 10 years ago is not the same risk factor as it is today. So it should be recalculated every few years because the risk factor can certainly go down.
What is the peak age for someone to come down with breast cancer?
So we sometimes, the important question is, when do we start risk assessment? So we start risk assessment at the age of 25. And that's when we start risk assessment. And we usually stop it at around 70.
Mammograms start at 25?
No. The risk assessment protocol.
Okay, understood.
Yes. No, mammograms start at 40. American College of Radiology, American Society of Breast Surgeons recommend for mammograms to start at the age of 40 and to be done on a yearly basis.
Okay, until when?
Generally, until somebody has a 10-year lifespan. So if they're in their 80s and we suspect that they're very healthy and they're going to outlive 10 years, then we continue the mammograms. If they're in their early 70s but they have a lot of medical issues and they're not going to live more than 10 years, then we may have a conversation where we may hold off on doing mammograms.
Are you okay with the current recommendations, age limits beginning on mammograms? I know there has been controversy.
I follow American College of Radiology and American Society of Breast Surgeons.
That doesn't mean you're cool with it.
I recommend that. Unless somebody has a first-degree family history, and let's say mom was diagnosed at the age of 44, then we would start mammograms at the age of 34. And that's why in starting risk assessment at 25 is so important. Because if we identify that somebody's high risk, then we may start imaging sooner.
Mm. Dr. Claudia Lago joins us from New Vance Health. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to Lenox, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on.
Hi, thank you for being here today. This is a very helpful program. I had two questions. You mentioned something about age of onset of menarche as a contributing factor.
I did, yes.
And so if someone started very early, would that be a contributing factor?
That may certainly be a contributing factor, yes.
For the positive or the negative?
For the increased risk of breast cancer.
Okay.
Especially if they didn't have children as well. So
yes.
I have several contributing factors, and I wondered, how do you find out if your local area covers a survey ultrasound?
All right, and you're in Massachusetts. I would say start with your insurance first, and certainly check with your insurance. The other thing is you may also discuss it with your primary or your gynecologist, whoever normally orders your mammograms. If you're considered to be dense breast and the radiologist has reported that in their mammogram report, then you may be considered to do a survey ultrasound.
Okay. Thank you so much for your help and all the information.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the call.
800-348-2551 is our number. If you have a question for Dr. Claudia Lago of New Vance Health, tell you what, let's go on over to Albany, and we'll talk to Elizabeth. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you.
Like
how are you?
I like hearing what you're saying, but I'm a woman of in my 80s now, but when I was in my 60s, I caught colon cancer real bad because I used to eat a lot of meat. I loved the taste of steak. Anyway, I don't eat meat today. But the colon cancer that I had, I was afraid to go to the doctors because I heard about how horrible it was and what the women went through and the men also. So I went and I started taking herbs. Medical herbs, and I did it for 2.5 years. And one night I went to the bathroom, and this big thing came out of me. It was soft, but it was round. I took it to the hospital, and they told me they didn't handle things like that. That was in Harlem, Manhattan. So what I did, I brought it home. I looked at it, and I flushed it. I wish I had to put it in the freezer. But talk about herbs. See, herbs. the right type of medical herbs.
Okay.
It will keep a lot of people from having operations.
All right, Doc.
They need to be put back in the diet.
Let's talk about herbs for a moment here. Thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate
the call.
Thank
you, Elizabeth. So,
you're welcome.
So we actually, that's important to bring up because along with prevention, we also talk about lifestyle modification. And certainly there are certain things that we do in our life that may put us at risk, like being overweight, not exercising enough, drinking too much, smoking. There's multiple risk factors. And what I always discuss with my patients is lifestyle modification. I always combine, and I'm a big proponent for Western medicine, so I follow standard of care. I'm not saying that treating something with herbs is something wrong, and definitely in certain cases it could be a supplement and it could be an adjunct to treatment, but I would not ignore what we currently have in our armamentarium.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. You know, we do a pets and vet show once a month, and we have a vet on who is very into Eastern medicine. And so I'll ask you this in a general way. Is Western medicine open enough to some of these perhaps not as scientifically and clinically provable methods as they should be?
I wish we were. We're not open. I would love more integrative medicine. There are physicians who do a lot of integrative medicine, especially in cancer care. And it's a phenomenal adjunct to treatment.
Hmm. All right. By the way, this wouldn't surprise you if you'd been on the show more than once. I probably screwed something up. So Peter wrote back. His wife was the one that was told she had dense breasts. And Peter writes very politely, "Thanks for your answer, but I think you missed the second part of my question, which is on me. So apart from diagnosing issues, are dense breasts a factor as a risk of cancer?"
Yes.
They are. Also, you mentioned dense breasts might be created after breastfeeding. Can you have dense breasts if you have never breastfed? And
yes.
We know that to be the case. All right. So, Peter, I hope you're satisfied. You're cut off now, and you can write in on the next one. 800-348-2551 is our number. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Jim in Matamoros, you're on.
What percentage of those patients treated with tamoxifen 20 to 30 years ago are having reoccurrence now?
All right. Well, first of all, what's tamoxifen?
So tamoxifen is a medication that's used to help with decreasing the chance of hormone receptor positive cancers. It depends. There's a lot of factors involved, and it depends on the full treatment aspect. But usually, for the most part, less than 10% of recurrence, especially after 20 years, we're not really expecting that much.
Jim, thanks a lot. Now let's go to Lenox, Massachusetts. Phoebe, you're on with Dr. Claudia Lago.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Phoebe.
I'm 62, and in the risk assessment tool, I don't quite reach the percentage for a prophylactic mastectomy. My cousin has had it twice. My mother had it. I have no children. And I would like one, believe it or not. And I would also not want reconstruction. And do I have to just wait till my sister gets it? Or how do we approach it? I'm guessing insurance just simply won't cover it if I actually wanted to pursue that avenue.
So interesting.
Well, Phoebe, thank you for the call. Have you been offered genetic evaluation and testing?
Oh, yes. I did have my breast tissue was dense when I was younger. As I've gotten older, it's not as dense. So I have mammograms. I have ultrasounds. Quite frankly, they're quite large, and I just really like them gone and not have to worry about it anymore. But yeah. I don't know.
Well, not just so even in the setting of a genetic mutation, we are actually shying away from offering what we call a prophylactic mastectomy, which is a mastectomy in the setting of no cancer. And the reason being is that it has been proven that it does not impact survival. So when we look at survival advantage, there's only a survival advantage in a subset of patients like Angelina Jolie's case, where she has a BRCA mutation. So having a very strong family history, unfortunately, does not necessarily mean that you will get cancer. Hopefully you don't. Or that it will be a positive impact in your health as well.
Phoebe. Phoebe's dumbfounded. Hello, are you still there, Phoebe? Okay. Well, thank you for the call. So what do you do, Doc, when somebody comes to you like Phoebe? I want the double mastectomy. I don't have cancer. It's not, I'm not, the algorithm says, hey, no. How do you talk people out of it?
It's a tricky question. It's a lot of education. One thing I would do, and in my personal practice, I offer genetic evaluation and testing if somebody meets criteria. And sometimes that can help inform somebody what their risk factors are. So genetic testing, what we do is cancer genes. And I particularly do a multi-panel gene test, kind of like the same way that you inherit certain traits from both mom and dad. You can also inherit traits that can also be increased risk of cancer. If somebody does not have a genetic mutation and they're still high risk, that does not necessarily mean that you're going to get cancer. And we talk about what would be the next steps in terms of risk assessment and how we would follow you in that aspect.
So when you talk about high risk patients and management, this would not be a high-risk patient, but you're still managing, sort of managing expectations and doing psychological massage as well, yeah?
Correct.
All right, let's take a quick break. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Dr. Claudia Lago of New Vance Health joins us. We'll be back for the home stretch.
WAMC comes from Dr. John Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. ENVisionSpineSurgery.com for details. And DePaul Housing Management, managing communities for seniors throughout the Capital District, on-site staff in campus-like settings. DePaulHousing.com for information and photos.
Wheels turning round and round. There is a beautiful version of Steely Dan's big hit here. And, you know, speaking of turning around and around, it's fun drive time once again. February 3rd, that's this coming Monday, is the beginning of the drive. The lockbox is open. Could use your support right now. It shortens the drive. Every dollar we raise counts on day one. And it's WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and we thank you in advance. We're joined today by Dr. Claudia Lago of New Vance Health, and let's go to the email bag here before we go back to the phones. This one's from Mandy. AI analysis of mammogram. Our imaging company is offering to send mammogram results to a company who uses AI for an additional review. It is not covered by insurance, so patients have to pay out of pocket for it. Can you explain what it is and it's worthwhile? Question mark.
So AI is something that has been experimented in the medical field as well.
Yeah.
The current data that we have is that AI increases risk of detection by 30-35%.
That's good.
In comparison to two fellowship-trained breast imagers. So it's phenomenal. Now, it all depends on the AI software. So obviously, you know, that's still in the experimental phase.
Yeah.
It's not offered widely. But yes, it can improve detection.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Sue writes in, I have dense breasts, but don't know my family history because I'm adopted. I get regular mammograms. How concerned should I be, and how should I follow up? And that's from Sue.
Well, thank you, Sue, for your question. I think that, you know, definitely discuss with your provider in terms of adding supplemental ultrasounds when you get your mammograms on a yearly basis. And if they can calculate your lifetime risk of breast cancer, and some mammogram facilities automatically calculate it as well. And if it turns out to be over 20%, then you are considered to be high risk. And even if you don't know your family history, a lot of the information can still be plugged in.
Now, you had mentioned doing a genetic panel, right? And you talked about how traits come from the mom and the dad. Dumb question, but I'm famous for them. Can you get, it's BRCA, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is only passed from the mom?
No, it can be passed from dad as well.
Interesting. Yeah, even if dad never had anything close to breast cancer.
So dad may have inherited the gene, and dad may have had prostate cancer or melanoma or pancreatic cancer, which are other organs that are affected by a BRCA gene. And he may pass on, may have been able to pass on the gene as well. Or even in the setting of no cancer, he may still be a carrier and pass it on.
It's tough to make that then a red flag if there's no cancer in the family, though.
Correct.
All right, let's go one more email, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from Robin. My mother had breast cancer in her early 90s. She only completed one round of treatment and then elected not to continue the treatments. She went on to live to 99+. Is late-onset breast cancer common? Does her experience have any impact on my risk factors? And that's from Robin.
Well, Robin, most of the times, cancers are sporadic in nature. So your mom, more likely than not, if there was no strong family history, had what we call a sporadic breast cancer, and more likely than not had favorable features, and that's why she had no issues for almost a decade after being diagnosed. It may or may not impact your risk factor depending on the rest of the family history, so something that you may certainly want to discuss with your provider.
We're joined today by Dr. Claudia Lago of New Vance Health, and let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Nancy is in Clifton Park. Nancy, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question about why they don't use ultrasound more as the gold standard, from what I'm being told, instead of doing a mammogram and then possibly an additional ultrasound. Or if it's just an insurance issue. Some people are, you know, as they age, they were saying the dense breasts change. So you may have been available for an ultrasound earlier on, and now you're not dense and you're not edible, apparently.
Okay.
So just wondered how that worked.
Doctor.
So ultrasound does not substitute a mammogram. It helps in diagnosing things, but ultrasound has a lot of limitations to it. And there's certain things that mammogram alone can pick up that ultrasound cannot pick up. And mammograms save lives. So this is why it's still the gold standard for screening studies.
Should MRI be the gold standard?
No.
Really?
Mammogram should be.
Okie doke. Nancy, you want to follow up?
Okay. No, that's great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-25. You were very emphatic about that. Mammogram should be the standard. But can't you see more with an MRI?
MRI is eligible in certain cases. So just to give you an idea, MRI does not necessarily increase our ability to be able to pick up additional cancers in somebody who has a newly diagnosed breast cancer. So for the most part, we use MRI on an individual case-by-case scenario, depending on size of lesion, density of the breast, age of diagnosis. But using an MRI on everybody is not necessarily the ideal situation.
Is it just cost?
No. Mammograms are still the gold standard. There are certain things that mammograms reveal that MRI doesn't even reveal. And there are certain things that cannot be seen with MRI that's seen with mammogram.
We're joined by Dr. Claudia Lago of New Vance Health today. Our number is 800-348-2551. Back to the phones. Nancy in Albany. Nancy, you're on. Hello, Nancy. Hello, Nancy. One more time. Are you there? All right, Nancy, maybe. Oh, there you are.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Oh,
you're on.
This is Marianne.
Oh, Marianne.
This is Marianne.
That's why you weren't answering. All right, go ahead.
That's correct. My call deals with implants after bilateral mastectomies. And the problem with the implants have been very painful, kind of laser-like, off and on pain. The suggestion now is to replace the implants. Do you have any additional information regarding that?
So, Nancy, that's a difficult question in the sense that it all depends on how long ago the implants were performed, the type of technique that was used by the reconstructive surgeon, were they placed underneath the muscle, above the muscle, what type of mesh they use, what type of implant they use, what size they use. So there's multiple factors involved in that. Some people do experience that when we used to routinely do the reconstruction underneath the muscle. It caused a lot of pain and discomfort. Now that we have changed to above the muscle, we see that less and less. However, there can be an issue with the implant itself, or there can be an implant rupture, or what we even call a capsular contracture that can be causing all these symptoms.
Nancy. Marianne. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Our screen
should it be capsular contraction? What would be the optimum remediation for that?
So that's a question for a reconstructive surgeon. They definitely may be able to offer you a capsulectomy with an implant exchange or a different type of reconstruction. But I would highly recommend that you discuss that with your reconstructive surgeon.
All right, Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. What are implants made of?
Implants can be made out of gel or saline. There's different types of implant textures, but usually the most common ones that we use are gel, which is a different type of silicone that it stays encased in the implant. The alternative would be a saline, which is literally a bag full of saline.
Right. Now, this was obviously a case where it was a double mastectomy and it was reconstructive. What about those cosmetic users? Is it an increase in your cancer risk down the road?
No.
No? Not at all?
No.
What if they rupture?
The cancer risk is for multiple scenarios, but we can still do mammograms even in the setting of implants. There are certain cases where cancers can hide underneath the implant and make it a little bit more difficult. But for the most part, we can still perform mammograms safely without implant rupture.
We're joined by Dr. Claudia Lago of New Vance Health, and let's go to New Paltz. Hello, Lindsley, you're on. No good? Okay. Well, sorry about that. We have some technical difficulties. Let's go to Angela. Angela, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Albany, New York.
You're on. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. Hi, doctor. I have a question that I have never gotten a decent answer, and that's about the consumption of soy. And I'm wondering, I know that it shouldn't be the soy protein isolate or anything. It should be organic and natural. What is the truth about consuming soy? It's in everything. Just about soybean oil, soy isolate, soy concentrate. It's hard to get away from it. And I've become vegan so I can make my own food and do a lot of things like that because some of the additives and the soy is just ridiculous.
Okay.
So what is the truth and how much? I'm 70 years old now. And how much should we consume and how?
All right, doctor, what do you think?
Well, soy is used as a filler in a lot of products that are already processed. It used to be thought that soy has plant estrogen, what we call phytoestrogens, and it could increase the risk of cancer. However, soy has been determined to be completely safe to consume. So it definitely depends on a personal preference and in terms of what type of products you want to consume and what you want to nourish yourself with.
All right, Angela, thanks a lot. And let's go to Holmesdale, Pennsylvania. Barbara, you're on with Dr. Claudia Lago.
Good afternoon, doctor. The question I have is probably a little strange. I was just wondering and very curious about, you had mentioned ill-fitting bras. How much effect does a bra really have on like your breasts and their future, so to speak?
So it does not impact breast health, but it can cause discomfort if it's not the proper fitting bra. There's no increased risk of breast cancer if you wear a bra at nighttime or anything like that. Those used to be myths. So you can safely wear a bra. Just make sure that you get fitted appropriately.
One more question, if I can.
Sure, Barbara.
And Aluminum in deodorant, what is your opinion on that?
Good question.
That's a very good question. I think that's in a very personal case scenario. Some people think that aluminum may be a contaminant and may increase risk of not just breast cancer, but multiple factors. And some people have gone to natural products.
No data to support that?
No real data to support it. But, you know, and the reason why they usually have you not wear aluminum-based products on the day of your mammogram is because aluminum obviously is a metal and can show as an artifact on the mammogram.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very
Barbara,
welcome.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go now to Saugerties. And Millie, you're on. Oh, Millie, you got to turn the old radio down. Millie's not listening on her phone. She'll be picking us up in a moment. Zach, why don't you just pot her down until she is ready? The number is 800-348-2551. It's my fault, doctor. I should tell everybody, hey, when you're calling.
Good afternoon.
Oh, you're on.
I am.
Hi, Millie. Go ahead. You got to turn the radio down.
I am. I'm on my phone.
Hooray. Well, you're on the radio, too. Okay. See, we hear you.
I am ready. I'm on my phone,
sir. Oh, for Pete's sake. Okay, yes. Well, we can hear me, too. But why don't you make a quick question and then listen on the radio? Go ahead, Millie.
Okay. My question is, I just finished up my Arimidex for 5 years, and I want to know, what is the general follow-up when you get finished with your medicine? Is it just once a year with the mammogram, or can it be twice a year? Or what can you do to keep in touch with yourself? I'd like to see a doctor every 6 months or so. They say 1 year is enough. It's not enough for me psychologically. So what is the regular routine?
Okay.
So every institution has a different protocol, but for the most part, after the first couple of years of being followed every 6 months, that's when the increased risk of recurrence of cancer coming back is higher. After that, and you've surpassed 5 years of treatment, then it's safe to say that once a year following with your doctors and your team is more than enough. And honestly, we have more than enough data nowadays to support that once a year mammograms are sufficient even after initial breast cancer treatment.
All right, Millie, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. And again, it's the end of the show. But if you call this program, you should make sure your radio's down and listen on your phone. And then, because there's a 20-second or so delay between all the things that our signal has to go through to get to you, and then we hear it coming back at us, and it's very confusing, although I sound fantastic. Let's go to Pauline in Ballston Lake. Pauline, you're on with Claudia Lago, Dr. Lago of New Vance Health.
I'll try to make this very quick. I wanted to know what the percentage is or the odds are of getting chest wall cancer after you've had a mastectomy, and also why we have to have a mammogram with an ultrasound, since I've heard many people say that the ultrasound is better. That's it. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Pauline.
Thank you, Pauline. So making it very quick. So mammogram, standard of care for women who still have breast. Ultrasound used as an adjunct in the setting of dense breast tissue, not somebody who has fatty tissue. The chance of chest wall recurrence, it depends per stage, but usually what we talk about is that it's less than 10%.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, good.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call, Pauline. All right, we're almost out of time here. We have a very short amount of time for Richard in Rensselaer. Richard, you have about 30 seconds to pose the question.
Yeah, there's Dr. Joel Brind at Brute College who did a meta-analysis of studies relating abortion to breast cancer and found that there's a definitely high rank due to the high amount of estrogen at the beginning of pregnancy and the lack of nursing after the abortion. So is that in your protocol?
So every case is a case-by-case scenario. The incidence of pregnancy-associated breast cancer, which regardless if there's abortion or no related, is actually very low in comparison to standard cancers. And those are things that we treat like any other cancer. It just depends on certain factors and traits for the breast cancer and the staging.
Okay, Richard, thanks a lot. All right, we're almost done here. Doctor, you have 45 seconds to cover everything I forgot to ask.
Important to know, get your mammograms. Mammograms save lives. If you know somebody who has a history of breast cancer, or strong family history, definitely discuss it with your treating team. Talk about your personal history. If you've had a history of cancer, just because you have the diagnosis of cancer is not necessarily an end-all be-all. We have a lot of treatment options available, and there's an improved survival advantage.
And just quickly, and I probably should have posed this question earlier, what is the survival rate?
It depends on the staging.
Okay.
It's all staging dependent.
All right. Dr. Claudia Lago. Wonderful job. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And we invite everybody to visit us at Neuven's Health. I'm over at Vassar Hospital in Poughkeepsie.
All right. Well, good job. And there goes the music. We are done for today. Thanks for being here. Support comes from Upstate Dermatology, now with an office in Saratoga Springs, providing medical and surgical dermatology services, including Mohs surgery, with 6 locations in the Capital Region and Western Massachusetts. Upstate Derm. Once again, thanks to Dr. Claudia Lago of Neuven's Health for being with us today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the great calls. Really terrific ones today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Ed Rosen. Thank you, sir. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Dan DeLurie will be back, and we'll talk climate change and clean energy technologies. He spent some time in the White House over the last 6 months. We'll talk about that, too. We'll see you tomorrow at 2 p.m.